Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 90, we're in Hong Kong, where we'll be hearing the headlines from this week's Asian Aerospace International Expo.
Interestingly, Airbus at the show were also pushing the A380 hard into the Chinese market. As a domestic carrier, they expect so many people within China to be travelling that the A380 could actually be a viable aircraft there connecting Chinese cities.
That was Murdo Morrison, editor at Flight International magazine, and we'll be talking to a pioneering property developer about what he's doing to preserve old Hong Kong as the city's urban landscape continues to change.
Architecturally, you know, there's nothing particularly remarkable in the area, but it's that the texture, the feel, the idea of a neighborhood with a certain sort of village quality to it that appeals to a lot of people.
That was property developer Alan Lowe, and later in the program, we'll be talking retail trends with Mark Cho, co-founder of the independent menswear store, The Armory.
I am a strong believer in what I would say is authenticity. Authentic goods that follow an old school tradition or goods that could only be born from a certain place.
And now from Hong Kong, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, March 13th, 2011, and you're at the Monocle Weekly here in Hong Kong, the studios of RTHK. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome our Hong Kong editor, Liv Levichnik. Hello, Liv.
Hello.
We don't have Andrew, we don't have Rob this week.
Yeah,
I know.
Right.
We were going to have them down the line in London, but it's just you and me today,
yeah,
holding down the fort. We decided about a year ago that we were going to open a bureau here in Hong Kong, and we have a slightly different model. I think probably residents and people who visited know that we have something of a hybrid and that it's both news bureau and also retail as well. But I guess I wanted to start your first impressions, because you came out to the market early on. You of course checked it out. You did your house hunting. But now that, I guess, what are you, 6-7 months into
yeah,
it now?
8 months, nearly 8 months. Yeah.
8 months. I guess impressions. I mean, first impressions, and maybe if there were prejudices, how they've been changed.
Well, I suppose, yeah, first impressions. It's a busy place. Super busy and chaotic at times, and I think that has sort of changed. I think I've learned how to deal with that, and it's but it's a fast moving place, and it's lots of things going on, and sort of this huge influx of new people moving through the whole time. So you just kind of, I still feel like a newcomer after 8 months, but you meet people all the time, and they've just been here a couple of weeks, or they've just arrived 3 days ago, or so. It's a kind of that's still the case, that it's just very fast moving, and
from the position of I mean, being here as a correspondent for us, I guess, again, I mean, you know, your expectations of what you thought it would be, and I guess, you know, the reality as it started to pan out, as much time on the ground in Hong Kong and in China, or sort of more time around the region. I mean, it seems like you're in Singapore a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
We should have maybe put you in Singapore.
Yeah, I've been down several times, yeah. But I suppose that Hong Kong is just such a good place for us to be in, also in terms of Hong Kong itself, but also regionally. It's just very easy to go down to Singapore, or to hop over to Shanghai or wherever it may be, so...
I mean, there's a lot of a discussion, and certainly if you follow the local press, there's a lot of issues sort of concerning, you know, press freedom, certainly across the border, but also, you know, even within Hong Kong as well, a lot of discussion as to what's happening. And have you found that in terms of transparency, that it's difficult to do your job? Do you come up against any obstacles that you think would be different from when you've certainly been working in Europe or elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think not so much in Hong Kong. I think it's fairly easy, fairly straightforward. But obviously, yeah, you do hear about things going on mainland China, and also trying to get information from there is actually quite difficult. Obviously, you know, I don't speak Mandarin yet, so that's obviously my own sort of fault that I can't, you know, pick up the phone and speak in Mandarin to people. But that's something that's proving quite difficult, and also just getting information, just getting people on the phone and just asking very straightforward questions can be quite tricky, and there's a certain amount of suspicion just when you say the word journalist, and
right.
But otherwise, it's okay, I think.
I mean, a lot of people talk about that the story is moving away from Hong Kong, and that it's clearly on the other side of the border, and that it's not just Beijing, and it's not just Shanghai, but it's Chengdu and many other places. I mean, is that what you feel? And I mean, do you feel that sort of tension? Because I mean, a lot of what we want to talk about on the program today is, you know, we'll be talking about retail, and we're going to obviously be looking at what's happening certainly that friction that exists, you know, between the built environment, what's happening in urban Hong Kong, as much as with retail, and we'll be talking about aviation, but the tension that sort of exists between, you know, this city and you know, the great cities that are moving, you know, at an incredible pace in China. Mm. Do you feel that there's, I mean, it's almost hard to say that Hong Kong would be insecure, but is there that sort of sense?
Yeah, almost, yeah. I'd say so. Perhaps it doesn't need to be, but there's, because Hong Kong is still, you know, it's Hong Kong, and it's so unique in itself. But definitely you see, you know, just talking about what's going on in Shanghai and in Beijing and the art scene and the fashion scene and so on and so forth, and even other places like, you know, in Shenzhen or in Guangzhou, or lots of interesting things happening there as well. So I do think Hong Kong needs to be...
on its toes?
Yes, yeah.
I touched on it earlier, that you spend a lot of time also in Singapore because it's, of course, an important commercial place for us editorially. It's a good jumping off point. Who do you think is marketing themselves harder? Because there are so many stories, you know, that we see, you know, every week. It's, you know, it's a new regional headquarters goes to Singapore, and then Hong Kong wants to talk up that they've landed a new headquarters. I mean, you deal with, you know, both sides of government, etc. Who's working harder? Who would you say is more aggressive?
Well, I think Singapore is quite aggressive in the way they, just focusing a lot on, you know, trying to inject a lot of not just money, but a lot of people power into the creative industries and so on. Then again, that's also taking place now in Hong Kong. They're trying to, you know, they want to develop the West Kowloon Cultural District, for example, but that's still, you know, years off. But I think that Singapore is ahead. On that.
The whole, you know, focus on the creative industries, I mean, both centers, you know, are really talking it up now, because I think for so long there's been, you know, a focus on high tech, and there's certainly been a focus on, you know, how do you, of course, you know, maintain and bolster your banking sectors. I mean, is it slightly surprising that the rest of the world's been talking about creative industries for a very long time, that these two places are only just kind of waking up to it now in terms of actively marketing it?
Well, I don't know if it's surprising. I don't think so. I mean, it's certainly about time. But I think it's, in the case of Singapore, I suppose that they had a very, you know, they had a plan in place where they would go for, you know, the sort of harder side of things first, and then something like the creative industries would follow later on. So no, I don't think so. I think it's something that's, you know, been thought through.
Mm. I mean, speaking of the harder side of things, you we sent you out to sea. You were out with the Singapore Navy. How was that?
Well, it was very interesting. It was quite amazing. Yes, we went out on a little tour.
Big boat.
On a very big boat. Yes, on one of the new frigates that the Singapore Navy has. Mm. And yes, it was impressive. And yeah, we were there for a day and a half, and just following what was going on board, and they were in assessment. It was fascinating, yes.
And also, I mean, interesting for you as a half Swede as well, because Singapore's defense model is very much, I mean, they've really followed the framework of Sweden's total defense concept, right?
That's right, yeah, yeah. They've basically, yeah, they borrowed it from the Swedes.
And, right.
Yeah.
Borrowed's a good word. That's a very diplomatic word.
Yes.
Well, we should probably, I guess, turn our attention from the sea, because this week the biennial Asian Aerospace International Expo took place here in Hong Kong at the International Airport. More than 11,000 trade delegates crowded the exhibition hall, along with 270 exhibitors from 32 countries. But amidst the packed program of static displays, business congresses, freight summits, and award ceremonies, what were the key themes and headlines that emerged from the expo? Well, Murdo Morrison is editor of Flight International, and he's been very kind to wake up very early in London to join us on the line. Hello, Murdo.
Hello.
We just missed you. I don't know how that happened. We must have passed in the air or something.
Yeah, we were out there for 3-4 days. I just got back to the UK yesterday.
I guess, you know, if you look at this, you know, big headline, of course, that Cathay Pacific placed a rather significant, you know, order over the past week. Also, some of the other Chinese airlines, Hainan, for example. I mean, but from the perspective of Flight International, what was the key headline for you?
Well, I think it probably was the big headline was the Cathay order, because that was just, you know, very, very significant. I think what was quite interesting about the Cathay order is that they still haven't opted for the A380, the Airbus A380, or indeed the Boeing rival, the 747-8, the new jumbo jet. So Cathay are really one of the, if you like, one of the few mega Asian, Middle Eastern, European mega carriers that haven't yet gone for either one of these aircraft. And it's an unusual move. They've gone for smaller wide bodies. So, yes, very, very interesting that they've... very important that they've gone for so many aircraft, but they haven't actually gone for one of the these new super aircraft on the market.
And why do you think that is? I mean, because as you said, it is an interesting strategy, and is it indeed a strategy that may, you know, are they of the view that potentially if they had, you know, three A380s, then they'd only have three frequencies a day to Tokyo as opposed to six? Is that it? They want to offer more flexibility? They just don't believe in the aircraft? What do you think it is?
Well, that is the argument. That's the argument that Boeing would come out with. Boeing, of course, also selling its 747-8, but Airbus's future depends a lot more on selling this big hub connector of the A380. Yes, and I think you're probably right. I mean, smaller aircraft, you can offer more frequencies carrying 250, 300 people rather than 450, 500 people. But interestingly, Airbus at the show were also pushing the A380 hard into the Chinese market. That's the mainland Chinese market, where there aren't really that many international carriers yet, but they're actually selling it, the potential of the A380, as a domestic carrier within China, which is very interesting. So they expect so many people within China to be traveling that the A380 could actually be a viable aircraft there connecting Chinese cities.
I mean, in many ways, that's been the hope of Airbus, I guess, you know, very early on. They thought this is going to be the aircraft that was also going to crack Japan, you know, a market that, you know, has long used 747s for flights of 70 minutes. And I guess that they thought that, yes, this is going to be the aircraft that they would be able to use as a shuttle between Tokyo and Sapporo. And it still hasn't happened. And I guess the view is, well, can we do the same between Beijing and Shanghai?
Absolutely. And Airbus sees this. I think they acknowledge that it's something that won't happen yet. I think they've said that they acknowledge that the A380 is a, if you like, a prestige aircraft. It's a flagship aircraft. It's aircraft that the likes of Emirates and Singapore Airlines, Qantas, Air France are using as a flagship of their fleet on the big, big international routes. But in theory, there is no reason why the A380 couldn't be used on domestic trips. If you had a route with so many people wanting to travel at a particular time, it would make sense.
Mm. Were there any main stories from the Chinese manufacturers? Was that something that caught your attention?
There wasn't an awful lot from the Chinese manufacturers. Obviously, the Comac C919, which is the new narrow-body hope for some competitor with the A320, 737, that Chinese industry is producing. I think there's a lot of skepticism about this aircraft on the market. I think, yes, Chinese carriers will buy it, as they will the smaller Chinese regional jet. But I think China's hopes yet of becoming an international manufacturer are maybe even a decade or two down the road, I think, before they can genuinely do that. They will get there eventually, but I think it's not something that's going to happen significantly over the next decade.
And you think that the CEOs of those manufacturers, are they also you know, sitting in the reality seat as well? Do you think they also recognize that too?
I think they recognize it. I think where they're certainly very interested in China is perhaps as a manufacturer further down the supply chain. They're all very interested in the Chinese airline market, but they acknowledge that to do that, they're also going to have to be seen in a way as Chinese manufacturers, or at least having some kind of industrial footprint within China. And Chinese industry, of course, in all industries, is moving up the value chain. It's no longer just a place to go for very, very cheap, if you like, low-value manufacturing at the very bottom of the supply chain. It's something where you can now put engineering resources into, where you can now have factories and partnerships, where you're building quite sophisticated pieces of equipment. It's just at the very top of the supply chain, whether China can emerge in the next decade as an actual airframe or as a manufacturer of complete aircraft. I think that's still, I think, one step beyond for them.
I guess also there's that marketing element, which we always come back to in the magazine, that, you know, whether you're talking about the automotive industry or even, you know, the manufacturer of Chinese sports shoes, that they haven't quite cracked how to actually create a brand around these things. And, you know, even if I flip through the pages of your magazine, sometimes you see ads for Chinese aircraft and you think, they have still a few tricks to learn from Airbus and Boeing.
I think they do, and others as well. It's a world that's been dominated for a long, long time by the Americans and the Western Europeans. We've got very sophisticated when it comes to marketing. But of course, the Japanese got there. You know, Japanese moved into very, very highly consumer marketing very quickly. The Chinese will have to learn that. I think there's still this image in China of sometimes very, very sort of sloppy regard for copyright and intellectual property. They've certainly got a long way to go before they can come out with very sophisticated branded consumer or industrial products, but they will get there eventually. But I think that's something that's not going to happen in the next Chinese boom, the Chinese boom that we're going to see over the next decade.
And on the notion of that boom, of course, when we talk about airlines, it's territory which is rather protectionist, to say the least. And I'm wondering, though, you know, if we look across, you know, the next, you know, 5 years, the next decade, we already see this incredible divide just in terms of what the offer is. And, you know, we talk about Cathay, or we talk about Singapore or Korean, what those carriers are doing in terms of innovation. And if you look to Europe, I mean, Europe looked like an innovator for a long time, but, you know, you sample the product of a European carrier versus the Asians, and you think, okay, the Europeans almost start to look like American carriers at that point. Do you think that we will see, just given the scale of the coffers that we're talking about, that, you know, if we see further deregulation, that these airlines will have hungry appetites to be buying up carriers, you know, in Europe?
It's possible. I think it's not something that's on anybody's radar just yet. I mean, there's inevitably going to be consolidation in the European airline market, and possibly even some more in the US market. There is still quite a lot of resistance to Chinese airlines coming in and buying airlines. I think what has been interesting in terms of Chinese finance coming in has been in other areas of aerospace, such as, you know, rather incredibly, general aviation, right down at the small end, private aviation, where the Chinese have come in now and bought or are looking to buy, close to buying, a number of small aircraft manufacturers in the US. And I think they see this as a sort of a route into the business. It works in two ways, because if you think about it, there is a technology path into the aviation industry, starting small, but you get the expertise in how to build small aircraft and all the aerodynamics and so on, and move up into larger aircraft. But there's also, of course, very critically, a huge need for new pilots in China. All these airlines that are emerging, they will need Chinese pilots. At the moment, there's no tradition of private flying. There's no tradition of flying at the weekend in China, of owning a plane. There are very, very few pilots coming up through the system. And China faces a huge problem here in training these probably hundreds of thousands of pilots that are going to be needed over the next decade. And general aviation is one route into that. So flying schools need small aircraft. And I think the Chinese acknowledge this as a way of getting the young people interested in aviation and coming up through the ranks of being pilots.
Mm. And I guess on the airline point as well, the Singapore Airlines investment in Virgin, I guess, is something of a cautionary tale, perhaps.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's perhaps a slightly different story there. But yes, if I was an investor in China or in Asia, looking at where to put my money, I don't think I'd be putting it into too many European airlines.
Wonderful. Myrna Morrison, thanks very much for joining us so early on the line from London.
Thank you.
Have a good day. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Hong Kong. Now, this city may be well known for its dense high-rise urban landscape, but a new wave of property developers are emerging who are reviving local neighborhoods and preserving the old Hong Kong. Alan Lowe is co-founder of Blake's, a company whose residential projects see return to street level and outdoor living and focus on the heritage of local communities. He joins us now in studio. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, Tyler.
All good?
Good.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, what you're doing, because this, you know, this city is, of course, you know, known for a series of big names who are globally influential, not in terms of just the developments they're doing here, but of course, you know, U.S. West Coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, really all over the world. And, you know, there's a certain, to some of them anyway, there's a certain monstrosity element to what's being done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly in the magazine, you know, we've been focusing on some of the things that you, you know, that you've been doing, and it's interesting to see that there's a side of sort of, you know, walk up old Hong Kong that that you want to preserve. And I mean, even I think the first time that we met, it was interesting because you were saying, you know, how it was a bit of a, you know, conversion, and people, you know, everyone wanted sort of the shiny and new. And that's part of what you do, in a way, but also it's about maintaining this vitality on the street. And I'm wondering, how's the battle going? I mean, have you managed to enlist more soldiers?
I guess what we ended up doing was kind of a response to the condition, in a way. Just to give you a bit of background, I guess over the last 15, 20 years, the city was practically dominated by big developer type of projects. Obviously, the government policies, how land was used. We've seen a lot of mega projects.
You're sort of talking like where you have a big podium and then put four towers on top of it.
Yeah, so the kind of urban redevelopment we're talking about, basically you either have new reclaimed land, or we're talking about large evacuation of a whole block, city block, that becomes kind of a mixed use hotel, commercial, shopping mall kind of concepts, which is not your idea of a typical city with 150 years of history. So I guess, what we're doing is kind of trying to respond to what is going on here. And in a way, we look at other cities in the world, and there's more to your shopping mall, landmark, Times Square kind of experience. Look at New York, look at London, It's about walking the street. It's about Wan Chai, which is one very interesting area. And Sheung Wan to us is another very interesting area, which I guess in a way caught my eye when we opened our first restaurant.
I guess what's interesting, was your way into this with food and beverage to start? I mean, you mentioned the first restaurant, when you thought, okay, if we're going to sort of preserve and revitalize, that needs to be, the starting point?
Well, we came across Sheung Wan by chance when we had the opportunity to do a restaurant. So I guess the real estate angle element sort of, it was kind of a secondary sort of reaction after we got to know a bit more about the area. And, as a relatively small player in the market, I think it's hard to sort of do something that is so completely choreographed. We're not looking to completely transform a city block. We're not completely looking to just sort of, let's just, theme the area, in a certain way. In a way, it's not what we've set out to do anyways.
No, I mean, there's that balance issue, isn't there?
Yeah.
But in a way that's, as you said, you don't want to. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to use the word gentrification. And also, you don't want to be in a situation where everything is perfectly done. I mean, you want to be able to leave some of the original people that were there. And it's fine if you want to also populate it with some of the things you do and also bring in other interesting players. I mean, because I would imagine what I've seen, what's happened so far, is that that's what's also kept it interesting. There's an authenticity to it.
Yes, and I think the whole idea is not to drive out the existing neighbors in the area. And what makes the area very interesting to most people is architecturally, there's nothing particularly remarkable in the area, but it's that the texture, the feel, the idea of a neighborhood with a certain sort of village quality to it that appeals to a lot of people, both locals and creative types, gallerists, art dealers.
Do you also feel there's been a demand, I mean, almost a sort of a groundswell of people who want to see this type of preservation in Hong Kong?
I think as a small boutique player, I mean, we will never be able to compete in the sort of mass, big scale realm, even if we want to be. Looking at Hong Kong, there's definitely an emerging sort of your, 5-10% of the audience who's looking for something else. And I suppose that's, where we are and, the types of people that we're looking at,
And is that as much driven by expats? I mean, people who grew up in London or New York or Berlin, who want that authenticity on the street as much as also locals who just want the Hong Kong of 30 or 40 years ago back again.
Yes, and also obviously a growing community of people who've lived and worked abroad in the past. I think it certainly appeals to your well-traveled, cultured type who appreciates, that's something else other than your glitzy, glamorous clubhouse and chandeliers and moldings and the aspiration of a palatial kind of, mega development,
Yeah. I saw some interesting hoardings for a building called Chantilly today, which is very much a wedding cake. I was asking Liv earlier in the program about Singapore versus Hong Kong and even versus Seoul. I mean, so many the major players in the region are now talking up creativity. Everyone is sort of had a sip from the fountain of Richard Florida, and everyone wants the creative community, and they want that investment as well. What's your take on that? I mean, how committed is local government to really ensuring that there are decent priced spaces for artists, and at least that there are, not that you certainly can't engineer bohemianism, but I guess lots of governments would like to think they could. But is there that sort of sense that also you have to sort of preserve and make sure there's interesting areas, and you can't just sort of put everyone in a new tower block?
Well, I think our government has always been very supportive. I think it really showed recently, I guess in the last few years, especially when late last year they've committed to awarding the former Mary Police Quarters on Hollywood Road, to earmarking it as a creative industries hub, studio, shop, exhibition kind of realm, which works perfectly with what has already been kind of developing in the area over the last 5 to 10 years. It's sort of unofficially become a very interesting district full of your design studios and creative types. I mean, real estate is always going to be a struggle for all these major cities, but I think Hong Kong will become very interesting, continue to be very interesting in the next 5 to 10 years. I think China, with all these opportunities happening in the region, I think, and in terms of lifestyle, I think it's Hong Kong still has an edge over our neighbors, I guess, in a way. And I don't know if it's fair to compare us against the likes of Singapore or Seoul, because I think we all have sort of our own unique qualities and our role in the region. I think Singapore, we just saw a new art fair happening over there, and which I've heard really good things. I think we're over with that sort of being competitive, but just trying to sort of sculpt your focus in a way.
Well, I don't believe that for one moment, but anyway, that's another issue. I think as of Friday, you just handed over a new project that you've been working on with Ilse Crawford, who was the founding editor of Elle Decoration in the UK. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's a small residential project. There are 5 apartments, each around 140 square meters.
And where would 140 square meters, where would that fit for the neighborhood? Is that quite a large scale?
It's a relatively large offering for the neighborhood, which traditionally are your typical sort of size of the apartment would be sort of in your 30-40 square meter kind of range. So it's kind of an idea to introduce a more sophisticated type into an area that sort of in a way continuing our effort to bring in sort of both residential and commercial and on the retail front kind of users, and just getting more people to live and work in their neighborhood.
I mean, and if this is obviously the opposite of a building like Chantilly, for example. So do you have also retail at the bottom, or is the whole thing residential?
There's one retail space on the ground floor, which we're yet to decide what exactly we want. Well, obviously we want to hold on to the retail portion of the building until we find someone who has an idea not too dissimilar to what we have, our vision for the neighborhood. We own another large space just 2 doors down with an Italian restaurant, Due Trento Otto, designed by Otto Bahn, and an arts and events space called The Space. So it's sort of this building, 226, is kind of a continuation of what we're doing in the area. Strategically, obviously we look at it as a one-off kind of project, but in a way it sort of ties in with what we've been thinking over the last 3-4 years.
Finally, before we go, who is the buyer? I think everyone is obviously sort of racing for buyers on the mainland, but was this more of a local play?
I think we've originally envisaged a very much a user demand rather than investors, and I think we were right. All buyers actually, except for one, are international buyers. Some are based in Hong Kong, some are not. And it's sort of your complete opposite of your typical kind of, West Kowloon mega development type, where, you get a lot of interest from, your mainland investors. So it's definitely a new market. I think there's definitely, you know, more demand than, you know, what we could offer. But, you know, we'll continue looking, you know, down the road to see if there's something else we can do.
Great. Well, you've certainly become sort of the mayor of Shenwan, it seems. Yeah. Right, Alan? Alan Lowe, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to Monocle Weekly here in Hong Kong. Well, the city may still be seen as a shopping mecca by many, but it also lags behind cities such as Seoul and even Singapore when it comes to new interesting retail concepts. At least that's our opinion. So what changes are being made and what still needs to be done? Mark Cho's co-founder of a new menswear store, The Armory, which you've probably seen in the magazine, offering a selection of high-quality brands from around the world that focus on craftsmanship. And he's, well, I guess by many you're probably seen as a breath of fresh air, certainly on the sartorial scene. What was the idea? Because Hong Kong, of course, has a legacy for tailoring, and whether you're thinking about shirts or suits. And then I think we saw two, even three decades of this luxury explosion. Was it just that there was a glaring gap in the market for you?
I wouldn't say I started The Armory out of sort of commercial interests. It was more, I've always had a personal interest in this classic menswear aesthetic, in tailoring in general. I've always respected the tailoring history of Hong Kong, and so it excited me to be able to be part of that history. But also, you know, because I like this classic menswear tradition so much, I really wanted to sort of try and promote it more in Hong Kong and in China.
Mm. Maybe talk us through the offer. You walk into The Armory and, what are the goods and wares?
I mean, I tried to style The Armory after sort of what I thought was me, really. And I would call the style internationally classic, as in we take a lot of elements of classic clothing, but we tried our best to bring together elements of international supply. I am a strong believer in what I would say is authenticity, authentic goods that follow an old school tradition or goods that could only be born from a certain place. So I got two examples. One example is, for instance, the suit I'm wearing today, which is a Liverano suit. And Liverano is a very old cutter that follows the Florentine cutting style, which is a slightly different style from the other sort of regional Italian styles. And so I would consider that, you know, pure Florentine. Like you couldn't really do that anywhere else. And it really carries that flavor.
And are you flying in on a quarterly basis, one of their tailors? Is that how you...
Yes, absolutely. Signor Liverano comes by every couple of months, takes orders, and then goes back, makes them, comes back, does fittings, and then eventually delivers the final product.
And then what's the other example?
The other example is Soso, which is a small, I suppose you could call it a design group. They deal in textiles, but a lot of ready-to-wear as well. And they are trying to take very traditional Japanese clothes, kimonos and whatnot, but trying to modernize it. But not in a gimmicky way. Like they're really, what they do is very sophisticated, very interesting. And I feel like it could only be born in Kyoto. It's not something I could see happening in, say, Tokyo or any of the other cities, just because maybe they're a little more westernized. They have a little bit less of a connection to that classic Japanese history, whereas Kyoto is like the perfect sort of burning pot for it.
Mm. It's a lot of what I see, and even, you can, of course, see photos of you on our website. But when I look at your style, it reminds me of you know, handsome men that you see in, very much Marinucci, the right streets in and around Ginza as well. It's interesting when you talk to a lot of Japanese magazine editors right now, a lot of Japanese buyers, they say it's amazing looking at China, looking at the Hong Kong market, you know, looking at Korea, that there's almost this Tokyo sartorial style, which is really being sort of picked up, you know, all around the region. And from your point of view, why do you think that's happened? Because, you know, Japan has been so much of a beacon for, of course, you know, innovative and street fashion. But why also the beacon for the sartorial style as well?
I think if you're just to speak about, you know, the genre that I specialize in, which is classic menswear, what the Tokyo guys do really well is they really follow that aesthetic in the most authentic way possible. You know, they get all the details right. And at the end of the day, they also add a little bit of a spin on it too. Plus on top of that, like the Japanese frame is obviously very suitable for this sort of clothing. They always look good in it. And they seem to have this sense for color that a lot of countries don't have.
Mm. Just focusing on the market here in Hong Kong, and maybe I was being a little bit, you know, harsh in the introduction, but there was almost an evaporation of tension in the city, that everything was sort of led by the major luxury goods brands, and you could almost say that let's say for small independents, they were almost sort of suffocated. They they almost sort of couldn't get, you know, a word in or, you know, or a shopper through the doors. Is that changing now? People are sort of looking for the mix. I mean, that's what you offer as well. I mean, of course, you can go to Lane Crawford and you go to the bigger stores and you can find, you know, a series of brands, you know, within, you know, a large floor footprint, not particularly cozy, let's say. You're going the other direction. I'm just wondering, are people sort of maybe perhaps fatigued by sort of the monobrand?
I think to a certain extent they are fatigued. Also, obviously, because I deal, you know, with men shopping, and men seem to like a quieter environment rather than a large environment, and they tend not to like sort of a woman plus man shopping environment. They prefer it to be just like a man cave sort of thing.
Right.
But and this actually goes back to what you were saying with Alan earlier. The way rents have been rising in Hong Kong really does stifle the development of small independent shops and sort of a more bohemian lifestyle. We got very, very lucky with our spot.
I mean, you're in Central.
Yeah, we're in Central at a reasonable rent in a very good spot, but obviously with no street frontage whatsoever, which is actually what we were looking for. Like, we did not want something on the street. We are not looking for walk-ins. We deal with, you know, people who really love this style or who are looking for a bit of advice on this style. Mm. So the location is perfect for us.
Is the Armory a one-off, or do you see this as something that you can take to Singapore potentially? Is it something that that might crop up in Shanghai or elsewhere?
People have actually approached us about that, and I would be interested. But obviously, and this is actually something that didn't occur to me when we first started, service is quite important, or service is actually of paramount importance. And a lot of people have come to us and said, oh, you offer really good service. We actually can't get this sort of service at, say, the bigger stores. And I guess it's because myself and also the couple of chaps I work with, Alan and Jonathan and Ethan, we really, really love this aesthetic. And so we know it inside out, whereas other people don't seem to have that degree of obsession. And actually, that's what's so great about the Japanese stores, too, is that, you know, the suit guys there, they blow their entire paychecks and they're sort of months and months of debt, with months and months of debt, because they spend all their money on their clothes, because they love it. They absolutely love it.
I want to go back to the point that you made about the man cave, Mark, that this is sort of an environment, you know, that your customer wants to spend time in. Your customer, is it very much Hong Kong and also expat scene here as well? And are you also seeing an influx of mainlanders as well?
When we first opened, I actually expected it to be sort of half and half expats and sort of Hong Kong Chinese, but perhaps with quite an international background. What it ended up being is actually more like 70-80% expats and 20% local Hong Kong Chinese and a tiny, tiny sliver of mainland Chinese. But to be honest, the Hong Kong side and the mainland Chinese side is steadily growing as well.
I mean, on that authenticity issue, there's, you know, we've seen so many of the major luxury goods companies, of course, you know, going like gangbusters, you know, some doing well, some kind of hard to say whether they're doing well or not in China at the moment. We've also seen a lot of them doing licensing deals. So, you know, they're also with their label, you know, they're making it in China as well. Is your view that, or what is your opinion on that? I mean, do you think that, you know, so many of these, you know, venerable European brands that are also doing production on the side in China, because, of course, they want to be in the market quickly, they want to have great margins. Do you think they're, you know, perhaps, you know, severing a limb by doing that? Because there comes a point, talking about Japan, for example, the market becomes so sophisticated that they are going to be turning over the garment and looking at every detail. And also they want to know that it's actually, if you're talking about heritage, it did come from this particular street in Florence.
I'll expand on this a little bit, actually, because this actually ties into another concern I have. Firstly, I don't have any issue with things being made in China. I think that there are actually a lot of really great things made in China. In fact, Japan is one of the best examples. I mean, you go to, for instance, Tomorrowland or Beams, and some of their really great own label stuff is made in China. It's made very carefully with a lot of quality control, and oftentimes it turns out much better than the sort of European version of it. But at the same time, it's always nice to have local production. There's something in local production that will always reflect the locale where it's born. And so it'd be sad to lose that at the same time. I mean, what we do is on a very small scale. So, you know, we can afford to have things made around the world. But obviously, if you wanted, say, a Liverano suit and, you know, 5,000 people a year want a Liverano suit, there's no way that could ever happen.
And what about even with, you know, within this market in Hong Kong, are you working with any tailor shirt makers here? Is there scope to also, you know, revive something which, you know, which is lost? Because, you know, everyone sort of remembers, you know, family members, et cetera, you know, who would come and actually have quite beautiful things made in Hong Kong in the 1970s. I don't feel that that happens so much anymore.
Oh, absolutely. We actually partnered up with a very good tailor called W.W. Chan. They've been around in Hong Kong for about 60-odd years. And when we first introduced them into the store, we actually did quite a lot of research into their history. It was very interesting to see how W.W. Chan, who's the founder and the grandfather now, he was born in Ningbo. And actually, he was trained in Ningbo. See, back in the day, actually, for tailoring for Chinese people, it was not actually studied in Shanghai. Like a lot of people talk about the famous Shanghai tailor, they weren't actually from Shanghai. They're from further north, because a lot of the schools teaching that stuff was further north as well. Plus, back then, there were actually a lot of sort of master class colleges that were based in Russia and in Japan. So, for instance, W.W. Chan actually did his course in Ningbo and then did the master class in Japan and then came back. And then, obviously, the war threw a spanner in things, and he had to move to Hong Kong.
Mm.
But unfortunately, that particular generation of tailor has started to retire. Some of them unfortunately passed away as well. But luckily, you know, there are still people continuing it. In fact, it would be really great to see more young Chinese people going out and trying to pick up these skills again. Going back to the Japanese, you see a lot of young Japanese people who left Japan 5 years, 10 years ago to start their apprenticeships with tailors, with shoemakers, and they're now just about ready to start their own ateliers, to start their own shops. And it's great to see them doing new and original work, too, and kind of continuing that trade.
Do you think that's a symptom of a mature and, I mean, one wouldn't say that Japan's necessarily confident, but, you know, there was a confidence, you know, at the time that you know, many young Japanese, their parents could sort of finance them to go off to Italy and do this. Because it's interesting how I think the region is really inverting in a way that Japan, on one side, has always been a nation of superior shopkeepers, but that we're actually seeing this whole generation of young Japanese. Yeah, I mean, as you said, you go to the you go to the atelier floor at let's say somewhere like John Lobb, it's, you know, a lot of young Japanese gentlemen who are there learning how to make shoes. Yeah, do you think it's it's part of, you know, Japan sort of, you know, they got to the point of, you know, world's second biggest economy, now they're at number three, but maybe it's, you know, it's time to actually maybe even have fun, and that's why that's happening in Japan at the moment.
I think maybe those young Japanese that went out, you know, they grew up in an environment that had a greater appreciation for these things, so they said, yeah, I really like this, I really want to go out and find out more about this and learn how to do it myself, you know. Plus, culturally, they seem to have the patience to go and learn something like that.
Right.
You know? I mean, obviously, it takes a long time. It's not particularly rewarding work at first. I mean, financially rewarding work at first. But potentially, after a while, it could be a very, very lucrative profession as well.
Mm.
And you're just starting to see young Chinese, young Taiwanese leaving and going to the UK or to Italy to start their apprenticeships as well. So it'll be interesting to see how long those guys last in those positions, whether they'll see it all the way through and become shoemakers or tailors, whatever, themselves, or sort of quit halfway and move more in a design direction.
Mm. What comes next? Obviously, seems the store is doing well here, but anything you can reveal? Aside from, of course, a wedding, but that's for another program.
Well, I do have a couple of ideas. I would like to try and grow the armory a little more in Hong Kong. And it would be lovely to see, you know, more armories around the world. But like I said, we, I guess, insist on a certain level of service. And so we need a very specific type of person. Singapore is very interesting to us, certainly for shoes. Plus, you know, Singaporeans could dress a little bit better.
You said it, not me.
Yeah, I know. I got a couple of Singaporean customers probably flame me later for that. But Shanghai would be another place that I'd be interested in. It would be great to be able to connect with the Chinese customer. And actually, I track the traffic on our websites very carefully, and I always check who's referring traffic to us. And it's interesting to see our shop and our images and our site getting picked up by Chinese websites, Chinese forums in particular, just because there's a lot more chatter and it's a lot more sort of grassroots. Plus, it seems like that sort of customer is very young, sort of mid-20s, late-20s, early 30s, rather than the traditional older tailoring customer.
Great. Mark Cho, thanks very much. We'll keep an eye on the street and see where an armory potentially pops up.
Thanks very much, Tyler. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Monocle Weekly. We're in Hong Kong. We're back in a moment. Back with Monocle Weekly, where it's time to say goodbye from Hong Kong. So we're about to go live.
Yes.
It was interesting listening to both Mark and Alan live, because they seem you know, they're very sort of focused on craft. I mean, it's a, you know, of course, it's a theme that we cover in the magazine a lot. They seem very sort of preservation minded. Do you think that they're kind of against the grain? I mean, you've been here for 8 months, or do you think that there is this sort of, you know, growing movement of people who think, you know, maybe we need to be a little bit more considered in terms of how we develop the city?
Yes and no. I think they're facing a sort of uphill battle, if you like, but it is growing, you know, and there are more and more of these young type of people who are coming onto the scene, and I've certainly met a lot of them, and they keep, you know, more people are arriving on the scene as well, but so yes and no, you know.
I mean, it's funny because our bureau shop is in Wan Chai. You've chosen to live in Shengwan, which is, it seems to be one of these areas that's become sort of, you know, a magnet for, you know, expats, locals, you know, wanting to have, yeah, sort of the apartment above the shop, you know, this whole thing. Is it the only sort of area, I mean, aside from Wan Chai, that you see this happening, or do you think there's other parts of Hong Kong where this is also sort of bubbling up as well?
I think there may be, of course, there's other areas also, but I think Cheung Wan is a very good, it's the best example, I would say. And obviously Wan Chai is very interesting, but Cheung Wan is sort of the place where you see the very local, the old Hong Kong mixing with the new, and these new interesting shops popping up and all the time. So I think that's really the area that's sort of where it's all happening, yes.
And I just wanted to pick up on Mark's point where, you know, he said that, you know, he thought that his business was going to be, you know, this, you know, maybe sort of more Hong Kong driven rather than sort of expat business, but it's really been sort of driven by expats. And in Shengwan, that sort of, you know, bohemian sort of creative vibe that's happening there, you know, do you see it's more local Hong Kongers, or is it expats?
Both, but I think it's more balanced there, definitely. Yeah, you see a lot more locals. It has a very, very strong community feel to it. So yeah, it's a mix.
Excellent, Liv. Thanks very much. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills. Our sound editor is Chris Sharp over in London. And a big thank you to the team here at RTHK in Hong Kong for graciously hosting us. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle column. And also our April edition with Liv's story from Singapore is going to be on newsstands and dropping onto desks and letterboxes over the coming days. Next week, we'll be coming to you from Tokyo. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Liv Levitchnik.
More next week. Goodbye.